Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the vacuum at the top of the chain of command following the forced resignation of General Flynn as National Security Advisor. Now, after two prominent people turned the job down, we will assess the candidates on the shortlist, three of whom are generals and the other a controversial former U.S. ambassador to the UN, John Bolton. Lawrence Korb, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorists, Tyrants, and Weapons of Mass Destruction, joins us to discuss the turmoil in the White House with qualified candidates turning down President Trump because of his refusal to take Stephen Bannon out of the chain of command and allow the new NSC advisor to pick his own staff and report directly to the president. Then we'll examine the unfortunate historical examples of the use of the term enemy of the people that President Trump called, quote, the fake news media in a tweet, which prompted Senator John McCain to warn, quote, the first thing that dictators do is shut down the press. Russian expert Mitchell Orenstein, a professor of Slavic in the Slavic department at the University of Pennsylvania, joins us to discuss what it meant if Joseph Stalin called you an enemy of the people, and the paradox that in terms of the checks and balances against Trump's autocratic tendencies, we have to rely on the CIA, the Pentagon, and a hawkish senator who Rand Paul has criticized, saying, we're very lucky John McCain is not in charge because I think we would be in perpetual war. Then finally, we will speak with a whistleblower about Donald Trump's fury at leakers following his warning that, quote, the spotlight has finally been put on the low-life leakers. They will be caught. Peter Van Buren, a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer who led two State Department provincial reconstruction teams in Iraq and was punished for blowing the whistle on massive waste, fraud, and abuse of taxpayer money, joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, When It's Time to Blow the Whistle, and the fact that a government official's oath of service is to the Constitution, not to a political leader. And joining us now is Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration and is the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorist Tyrants and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Korb.
It's nice to be with you again, Ian.
Well, thanks, Larry. And what's your take on this? First of all, Leon Panetta warned, and so did, by the way, General Tony Thomas, the head of JSOC down at CENTCOM in Florida, that, you know, there's nobody minding the store and we are a nation at war. And both the general and the former Secretary of Defense and head of the CIA warned that if we had a real crisis at this moment, we'd be in big trouble. Do you share that alarm?
Yeah, no doubt about it, because you have a real crisis. The president has to make a quick decision. It's important that he hears all of the pluses and minuses of the decisions and the ramifications. I mean, if you look at, you know, for example, how they drafted that order of, you know, barring the people from the countries in the Middle East, they didn't check it with the head of Homeland Security, General Kelly, about people already with visas and green cards. I mean, just things like that that you need to make sure before you make the decision. And if you need to have it quickly, you better have a national security advisor there who can come in and make sure you understand everything before you do it, because this could happen. You remember the old thing about Secretary Clinton and the 2008 campaign, the 3 o'clock in the morning phone call?
Well, I take it that Donald Trump is interviewing candidates as we speak, but what do you make of the shortlist? First of all, the acting National Security Advisor, Keith Kellogg, is now replaced, or he's in the position that General Flynn was in. But the others are being touted are Lieutenant General McMaster and Lieutenant General Robert Caslin. And then, of course, John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who I remember actually was a recess appointment, wasn't he? He wasn't even approved.
Right. He could not get confirmed by the Senate, so they gave him a recess appointment, which allows you to serve up to 1 year if you're appointed when Congress is not in session.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with these the two generals, well, three generals actually. Since you served in the Pentagon, isn't it a good idea to have a civilian in that role, if you, particularly if you've got a lot of generals in the cabinet?
Well, I think so. I mean, General Mattis is a terrific person, but the question becomes when he gives his advice, is he speaking as a Marine or is he speaking as a civilian? Because you've already got a Marine general, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, to give you that perspective. In the same way, you know, have General Kelly over at, you know, Homeland Security, and if you put another general there, the real question is, and these are terrific people, don't get me wrong, but if you spend 30 to 40 years of your life in the military, you're going to approach things from a different perspective than somebody like you quoted, you know, Leon Panetta, who was in Congress and, you know, served as head of the CIA before he became Secretary of Defense.
So what the one person about whom I know a little bit is Lieutenant General Robert Caslin, and I understand that he is a favorite of Vice President Pence, largely because he's a fundamentalist Christian, and he was he violated the Defense Department's ethical guidelines by appearing in a video promoting Christian Embassy, which is a nonprofit evangelical group previously known as the Campus Crusade for Christ. So that's a little troubling, isn't it? If, you know, we've already gotten an awful lot of trouble in the Middle East by getting involved. Remember, George W. Bush used the word crusade, which, of course, backfired rather violently. And it's just the last thing it seems that we need in that theater, which still dominates U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You know, if he brings that perspective that we're quote-unquote with a war with radical jihadists and all that, that's going to undermine your ability to deal with them because you're never going to defeat them militarily. You have to be able to undermine their ideology, and people will use that and say, see, we told you, you know, the United States is out to destroy our way of life and Islam. And President Bush, to his credit, he did, you know, he'd use the word crusade, but then, you know, he did go to a mosque and you know, I think kind of try and temper his remarks. But no, that would not help. And in addition to Pence, Bannon, who's the, you know, is the political advisor who's got himself a seat on the National Security Council. See, his daughter went to West Point, where General Caslin is currently the superintendent.
So, again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Korb, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of State in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorist Tyrants and Weapons of Mass Destruction. Now, you mentioned the Bannon. I understand that that was the sticking point with both General Petraeus and Admiral Howard, that that Trump would not take Bannon out of the chain of command. And he apparently is pretty much has created a little sort of coterie of people around him, particularly Jared Kushner, the son-in-law, and that you've really got to go through him to get to the president. And that is not acceptable for a national security advisor. He has to have instant access to the president, does he not?
Very definitely. I couldn't imagine Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft, or Henry Kissinger, you know, some of the more illustrious national security advisors who would, you know, abide by this. And, you know, and even putting Bannon on the National Security Council, I mean, that was set up after World War II to make sure that the president heard from the key people in the national security arena, Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and head of the CIA, and to put, you know, a political operative, you know, on there just, you know, basically undermines the process. And that's the key thing. We can argue, you know, President Trump's philosophy or how he sees things, but what we want to ensure is that before he makes a decision, he understands all of the ramifications. And when they put Bannon on, they also said that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the CIA would not come to all the meetings.
Well, I understand that in the case of, I'm not sure of the details of why Petraeus turned them down, but I recall that extraordinary audio tape that surfaced when Petraeus was in Afghanistan, and Katie McFarlane, who's now the Deputy National Security Advisor, she was an emissary of Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch, who went over there to try and recruit Petraeus to run against Obama in his second term election. And Petraeus turned her down. But it's the most amazing exercise in hubris on the part of the Fox people. It's just breathtaking. So I thought that might be a problem for Petraeus, having her. And apparently that was an issue, that they didn't want her. But they also wanted to get rid of General Flynn's staff. He's brought mostly of the people that he knows from the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, into the National Security Council. Is that your understanding? Yes, it is.
And I think part of the problem with General Petraeus is, don't forget, he has a conviction, you know, that he's still on probation, theoretically. So he'd need permission from his probation officer if he had to travel to places around the world. Now, I'm sure he could get that, but I think that also played into the decision not to, you know, not to offer him the job, as well as I think General Petraeus correctly recognizing that, you know, you couldn't run this with somebody like, you know, Bannon in between you and the president.
But the other candidate, retired Vice Admiral Robert Howard, he turned them down, and apparently then the White House got back in touch with him and tried again to recruit him. And he, in the interim, Admiral Howard watched the president's recent press conference and decided, in fact, he's quoted as saying that the place is a excrement sandwich.
Yes. I mean, yeah, if you listen to that press conference, you know, the president saying a lot of things which were not, you know, correct and wandering all over the place. Yeah, I mean, if you are, you know, Admiral Howard, Vice Admiral Howard, who the Navy SEAL, who worked for General Mattis in the Central Command and has been, you know, all over the world conducting operations, and he looks at that and he says, well, you know, I don't want to put my, you know, men and women who, you know, I might have to send into battle, you know, with these people in charge, as well as the fact that he also wanted to get rid of the deputy, K.T. McFarlane, and bring in his own deputy. He had, from what I understand, he had a terrific person in J.D. Crouch, who now runs the USO, but he had worked as an assistant secretary of defense and also was Steve Hadley's deputy as the NSC advisor under Bush.
So what do you know, Lawrence Korb, about the dismissal of Craig Deere on the National Security Council? He was senior director for Western Hemispheric Affairs. And apparently he got kicked off because he criticized the president and some top aides. At least that's what Politico is reporting.
Yeah, and again, I'm sure that he was not happy with the presidential executive order they put out about who could come into the country and who should, you know, not come into the country, and just the way that it was done in terms of you know, being enforced, and, you know, holding people up at airports, and breaking up families. And I'm sure that was probably, I mean, I don't know for, you know, a fact. We'll have to wait till, you know, he speaks. But I mean, I can imagine if you're on the National Security Council and you see this thing come out with, you know, nobody having, you know, really vetted it, you've really got to be concerned.
And what do you think is happening in terms of the reason why General Flynn was forced to resign, and that is his contacts with the Russians' ambassador? One of the reports I'd heard from a former senior National Security Council staffer was that it's actually a lot worse than reported, that Flynn may have even tipped the Russians off about the sanctions that would have frozen the money of a lot of Putin's inner circle, the so-called Siloviki, many of whom parked Putin's money as well, and that they were able to shift the money before the sanctions. Had you ever heard of anything along those lines?
No, I haven't heard anything like that. I think the reason that they basically threw Flynn under the bus was the vice president, when he found out that Flynn had misled him. And I think he, you know, basically made it clear to the president that, you know, you can't have a situation like this. It's pretty clear Trump, the president Trump, knew what Flynn had done. okay? And it wasn't until it was reported, you know, that, you know, he had misled the vice president, it came out that they had to do something. Basically, we know Trump knew about this, you know, what Flynn had spoken about at least 2 weeks before, you know, it came, you know, it came out. And I think that's another sign of the, you know, the chaos. Did President-elect Trump tell Flynn to talk to him? Did he clear that? I can't imagine any other national security advisor say, you know, Mr. President-elect, I'm going to talk to, you know, the Russian, you know, ambassador, and this is what I'm going to bring up. And again, you know, General Flynn is a military person, so I'm sure he would have checked with his boss before he did that.
Well, the other extraordinary thing was that they didn't tell Pence about it when they knew. And he was the victim. At least he was the excuse for firing Flynn. And his spokesman made it real clear that the vice president found out about it from press reports.
Right. I got to tell you, though, one optimistic thing. I'm glad that General Flynn is gone, not the way that it happened. But he was not cut out for that job. You know, he is the type of person you'd want to go to war with. If you or I or, you know, we send any of our sons or daughters, want him on the battlefield. But he's not a good manager. I mean, when he ran DIA, he had all kinds of, you know, problems there. And so, in a sense, that might be, you know, a blessing. Now, I was hoping Admiral Horwood would take the job, and then, you know, that I think would have, you know, steadied the ship, if you will. Hopefully now, if you know, any of the other candidates, General McMaster, General Kellogg, or General Castlin, if they take it, they'll, you know, ensure that they have some control over the process. And I think, at least as I know about them, they're all much better managers than General Flynn was.
Well, just in closing, Lawrence Cobb, do you think that that any of these candidates, that Petraeus and Howard, we sort of talked about some of the reasons that have been reported in the press of why they turned the job down, but do you think there's a problem with the president himself and the extent to which there are these investigations ongoing about the cloud that hovers over him of legitimacy about him and his presidency because of Russia's role in the elections, which is one, the most curious part of which is that the president himself has not done anything to clear the air. In fact, if anything, he's done more damage by reinforcing this peculiar affection he appears to have for Vladimir Putin.
Well, I don't think that there'll ever be definitive proof that the Russians were able to, you know, turn the election over to Trump. But I do think the real question is going to be his relationship, the president's relationship with Putin. I mean, when they had that phone call and Putin offered to extend the arms control agreement, the so-called New START agreement, for 5 years, any other president would have jumped at that without even thinking, because all of the members of the, you know, former heads of the Strategic Command all endorsed that agreement. And basically, it would have allowed to bring stability and also enabled him to take money away from this trillion-dollar modernization program we're undergoing. But, you know, he didn't know about it. Then he said it was a lousy deal.
Because it was an Obama deal.
Right. Yeah. And you know, Obama, you know, basically he did that because that was the best he could get given, you know, needing the two-thirds vote in the Senate. He wanted to come down from those 1,500 down to 1,000 nuclear weapons, but there was just no way that he was going to be able to get that approval of two-thirds of the Senate for that.
Well, there's an example of why you need an adult in the room, isn't it?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, yeah, somebody would have said, no, Mr. President, you know, that's a good deal. Take it, and then we can, you know, that'll extend it to 2026, and that'll give us time, you know, to decide about modernizing, because we have a trillion-dollar modernization program that we're undergoing now, which you can't afford. So you'd be able to, you know, to make some, you know, changes with it. And the Russians have economic problems, too. I think they might have been willing to go down, you know, to 1,000 from the 1,500 that are in the New START agreement.
Well, Lawrence Corbett, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Corbett, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and a senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration as the author of A New National Security Strategy in an Age of Terrorist Tyrants and Weapons of Mass Destruction. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the unfortunate historical examples of the use of the term enemy of the people, which President Trump called the fake news media.
Oh, no. Oh, well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Yes, war no more. Well, I ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Ain't gonna study war no more. Gonna lay down my hymn book down by the riverside.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mitchell Orenstein, who's a professor of Central and East European politics in the Slavic Department at the University of Pennsylvania and an associate of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books, including Out of the Red, Building Capitalism and Democracy in Post-Communist Europe, and he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Russia's October Surprise. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mitchell Orenstein.
Thanks so much. Yeah, thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
Thank you, Mitchell. And before we get into the enemy of the people, of course, a famous play by Ibsen, let's talk a little bit about the October Surprise scenario.
Absolutely.
In the sense that, at the end of the day, do you think this whole meddling in the U.S. election has backfired on Putin? I know he's very popular, but I imagine there's got to be some people in the, because we know there was some dissent within the ranks, and that's probably why his chief of staff, Ivanov, was fired. And Medvedev, his prime minister, apparently objected to it, this program on the, which was apparently a massive operation to interfere with the U.S. elections. A lot of the more seasoned members of the intelligence community and foreign policy community in Russia thought it was very reckless. So where does it stand now in terms of, you know, what they call in the military an after-action report?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you've got to wonder what were Russia's objectives with this hacking, right? I mean, all along, one of the things that's been very notable about it was that it was so visible and so public. So it was obviously inviting a kind of a backlash. And the Steele report, which I think you're referring to, talks about divisions within the Russian hierarchy, trying to think about whether it's a good thing to go in and hack and, you know, get the result you want, or whether it could backfire. The report states that the Russians in general, and Putin's objective overall, was trying to turn America pro-Russian. And in that objective, you have to say that he's really failed, that this is going to cause a major backlash. They're already backing away from Trump. They realize they've sort of wakened a lot of anger about Russia, and, you know, that's extending also to Europe, where it's much more visible, the types of things they're trying to do in France and hacking their election, or Germany. So you do have to wonder. I mean, Putin sometimes is called a great tactician, but a poor strategist. And I do see that here. I think that this is a strategically disastrous move ultimately for Russia.
But if Putin's aim was to weaken America, then he succeeded in the sense that Donald Trump is clearly out of his depth and creating a lot of disarray. And even the Republican leadership, who have benefited from the election, and he's delivered the power that they want to prosecute an aggressive agenda. My understanding is that they can't even push their agenda through the way that they're hoping to because of the distractions from the White House.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, if, you know, this is the thing, is we don't know exactly what the Russians' objectives were. Certainly part of it could have been, or one theory is that they were trying to simply disrupt the American political process and make us look like a laughingstock. And there they've certainly achieved their goals, if that's what it amounted to. You know, I think that I do buy that to some extent. I think that that definitely they're trying to make us look weak and be weak, and in the sense that if Russia went and invaded Belarus today, like what would we really be able to do with that? You know, could we really bring along European allies to stand up to Russia in important matters, you know, when we have so much turmoil at home? It's a possibility. On the other hand, I think what the Russians are seeing with Trump, and what everybody's seeing with Trump, he's quite unpredictable. So we simply, I don't know if it's a quick win for them either. In other words, if they did anything, you know, there's so much anger at Russia right now and so much pressure on the Trump administration to try to react in some way that that also could fail. So I think it's a, my gut instinct overall is that they were trying to elect Trump. They got Trump. They got a little bit more than they bargained for. They showed their hand. You know, spy operations were supposed to be not seen, not heard, just effective. This was seen, it was heard, and I don't know how effective it's ultimately going to be to them.
And again, I'm speaking with Mitchell Orenstein, who's a professor of Central and East European politics in the Slavic Department at the University of Pennsylvania and an associate in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. He's the author of a number of books, including Out of the Red, Building Capitalism and Democracy in Post-Communist Europe, and he has an article at Foreign Affairs, Russia's October Surprise. In the opening I mentioned, which you didn't hear, Mitchell, was that... I talked about what it meant if Joseph Stalin called you an enemy of the people, and you've commented on that to the BBC, which I want to follow up on. But the broader question that I have in terms of what we're just discussing is that in terms of the checks and balances against Trump's autocratic tendencies, we have to rely on the CIA, the Pentagon, and a hawkish senator who Senator Rand Paul has criticized, saying we're very lucky John McCain is not in charge because I think we would be in perpetual war. So that's the kind of strange situation that one finds oneself in, you know, when you, you know, obviously Russia punches above its weight. I think its economy is something close to the GDP of Canada next door. I don't think it's, you know, I wouldn't be paying that much attention to Russia, but for the fact that they might well have helped put a president, their guy in the Oval Office, where the real power is. America's the real power. And that's where I think it gets a problem. I mean, not Russia itself is not a problem, and I don't think there's any great reason to fear Russia. But I sure as hell don't like the idea of them putting some guy with autocratic tendencies in the White House to create some autocratic world order.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think Putin's calling the shots, right? I mean, to the extent that it's true that that he supported Trump's campaign and with, you know, all the hacking, stealing of information, leaking of information, the fake news, the thousands of trolls kind of supporting Donald Trump who were paid, you know, out of Russia. You know, he is kind of calling the shots. And I think what he really wanted was a quid pro quo, right? And what he wanted was he wants the United States to drop sanctions. And I think that's exactly where the problem comes, is that the Congress, given the outcry right now, is not likely to drop sanctions on Russia. And those sanctions are badly hurting the Russian economy. They've starved it of foreign direct investment. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have a, you know, the United States is a big, diverse country with lots of centers of power. With the Congress, obviously the Republican Party controls most of the main, you know, elements of power right now. They control the Congress. So, of course, it's going to be Congress that is responsible for investigating the Trump campaign's ties and Trump administration's ties to Putin. It's going to be the GOP Congress. And so the question is, when are they going to get, you know, bold enough to sort of say, look, we need to look into this? And are they going to ultimately, if they find what we suspect they're going to find, are they going to be willing to take action, namely impeaching the president? And I don't think we're there yet, personally, but we might get there after another month similar to the one we've had. However, I'd also point out, you know, that there's journalists like yourself, there's professors like myself, there's Democrats who are in control of a number of state houses throughout the country. There's the court system, which has lots and lots of justices appointed by a number of different presidents, including Obama. So there's lots of centers of power in the United States. And I think that what you're going to see if we keep going down this path is that there's lots of ability for different sorts of people. It's not just McCain and it's not just the GOP Congress. It's a very, very large set of institutions and people who have power to force an investigation and to force some changes.
But I guess, do you see it as a little ironic that in order to, as a check and balance against somebody that appears to be have autocratic tendencies, shall we say, mm-hmm. in the form of Donald Trump, that we we have to rely on the CIA, which is not exactly famous for its democratic kind of reputation.
No, you know what I think about that is that, look, the security professionals in this country, there's a lot of people in D.C. and elsewhere in the country who are paid to think about the security of the country. You know, frankly, most of us in the United States don't spend most of our days thinking about what would we do in this sort of scenario. But we do pay a lot of people who are highly qualified to think about our security and guard our security. And these people have been crying out saying there's a big problem here. The question really, I guess, comes down to one of credibility for me. In other words, is the evidence credible, right? Is the evidence that they're presenting credible? As I said, they're part of a very, very broad spectrum of the American people who are very concerned about these things that are going on, the ties with Russia and the Trump campaign, the Trump administration. They're not the only ones, however, but right now they have a particularly strong role because they're the ones who are employed in the FBI, for instance, CIA intelligence agencies, to get to the bottom of the factual information, to, you know, look at classified information, to look at secret telecommunications pools. They're able to pull bank account records, you know, from foreign countries. So at this moment in an investigation, yeah, you rely on the criminal investigation front, and first of all, the FBI. And the FBI does have extraordinary power, but they're the ones who are in charge of, criminal investigations of federal crimes at this level. And so, yes, that's unfortunately where we are.
Well, of course, there are some questions about Comey himself in terms of him Absolutely. Perhaps tipping the scales, although he did gave the Senate Intelligence Committee a briefing the other day, and the body language of the senators coming out, at least to the observers, seemed like they were in shock about what they heard. And I believe there's, three separate FBI investigations going on.
Yeah, if you think about it, I mean, you know, Comey probably probably did in Hillary Clinton. Now he's about to do in Donald Trump. And that will be, you know, looked at as a very shocking thing. I frankly have never made up my mind about Comey. I mean, I think he definitely, made a huge mistake in releasing a not very substantial claim about Hillary Clinton just a few days before the election. I think that was a huge mistake. However, if you ask me what his motivations were, I really couldn't tell you. It appears to me that he's a very serious guy. He's trying to do a good job. He takes his job, his role very seriously. He obviously faces a lot of partisan pressure, but it's very possible that he is the type of person who just wants to get to the bottom of these things. And unfortunately, both these candidates had some major issues. You know, one, in my view, much more major than the other. I mean, you know, conspiring with Russia to tip an election is a high crime. I think that would be more serious to me. But nonetheless, these are both serious things, and probably he's approaching them in a serious way. And I do believe that he would like to get to the bottom of it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Mitchell Lawrence, let's talk about Enemy of the People. Of course, that was Ibsen's play an enemy of the people.
Yeah.
Hitler used the term, Goebbels certainly did. Each Jew is a sworn enemy of the German people, he said in 1941. And of course, Joseph Stalin, if he branded you an enemy of the people, that was a death sentence. But in terms of Trump's autocratic tendencies, the fact that he loves to have these rallies, which is the hallmark of despots, that's what they do. They don't govern. They govern in secret, but they go out. The only interaction with the public is they hold these rallies like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela and Fidel Castro in Cuba, and they just, you know, love the crowd and rile them up and do all that popular stuff that Trump seems to. It's almost like Trump is. It's a Groundhog Day situation with Trump. He clearly doesn't really want to govern, at least doesn't know how to. But he sure likes to go out there and relive his, best moments of his campaign. And the country's not making any progress, but he keeps going back and back. You know, it's a very strange situation. But in the broader sense, is it indicative of a kind of autocratic impulse?
Well, there's no question that Trump has an autocratic impulse, right? He's kind of a strongman style. He's this populist style. He says, "I alone can, fix the country," that kind of thing. The rallies, are certainly a part of it, although, I wouldn't want to demonize rallies. I mean, he's probably the only Republican at this point who's has the courage to go out into public at this point and talk about, his point of view. A lot of Republicans are canceling their town hall appearances because they're facing angry crowds. So, I think that he does have that impulse. The real, and this is shown also in his embrace of Putin, his use of the words of dictators without really much thought. And even when he does think about it or consider it, he's still going on, using these terms. So there's no question about that. I think the question, the big question, is how far can he actually achieve the consolidation of some type of authoritarian regime in the United States? And frankly, my opinion is not very much, right? So
sure.
He in the first 4 weeks has been an utter failure for him. And I think the issue is, a lot of it is his authoritarian style, right? The not being willing to have ethics investigations of his appointees, that's just going to run him into problems later. Not, reviewing the executive orders by, the different divisions of the government and lawyers, that is run him into problems. The United States political system is not really set up for a single person to be a dictator, right? And there's lots of checks and balances.
Sure.
His first court case defeat was by the Attorney General of Washington State. So I personally am pretty convinced that that he does have that impulse, but that will be checked. And the question is, what does he do next?
Well, Mitchell Lawrenstein, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you. And it's great to speak to you.
Thank you. Likewise. And again, I'll be speaking with Mitchell Lawrenstein, a professor of Central and East European Politics in the Slavic Department of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also an associate at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University and the author of Out of the Red, Building Capitalism and Democracy in Post-Communist Europe. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a whistleblower about Donald Trump's fury at leakers following his warning that the spotlight has finally been put on the low-life leakers. They will be caught. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. Through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. And he has an article at the New York Times, When It Is Time to Blow the Whistle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Van Buren.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Peter, the President Trump on Thursday issued a kind of pretty naked threat. The spotlight has finally been put on the low-life leakers. They will be caught. And he also went on to say that they're going to really be punished. It turns out a lot of them are actually people in his own team, from what I can understand. But in general, have you seen anything quite this vindictive in terms of leakers? I know all presidents have their problems with leakers, but President Trump seems to be taking it to a point of obsession.
Absolutely. We're clearly in some news times here. Basically, the more secretive an administration is, the more likely it is that people are going to leak or blow the whistle or otherwise try to disclose information that's being kept from the public. There's an absolute relationship between these two things. And Donald Trump, in many ways, is bringing this on himself by refusing to be as open and transparent with the American people as it appears the American people would like him to be.
Well, of course, he's the same Donald Trump who during the campaign said, I love WikiLeaks, and then challenged the Russians to hack into Hillary Clinton and release the 33,000 emails. So you can't really have it both ways, right? I mean,
no, you can't. I mean, the American public can have it both ways, and I'm very glad about that. I am 100% in favor of as much information and disclosure as possible. Where it comes from is less relevant than informing the people about what their government or what the candidates who want to run that government are doing. In Trump's case, he's just expressing, I'm afraid, more crudely what I suspect a lot of politicians think privately, which is, you know, if you want to put out information that's negative to my opponents, then it's a good thing. And if you want to put out information that's negative to me, it's a bad thing. Difference is that it's no longer candidate Trump. It is President Trump. And that changes the obligation for people inside of the government. It's no longer political muscle tussle or gossip or what have you. It's now information that's essential in a democracy for people to understand what's going on in the government that they chose, that they fund, and that they depend on for their safety and security.
But in your case, Peter Van Buren, you wrote about what happened in Iraq, where you were leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams, and your book, We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People, documents the waste, fraud, and abuse at the expense of the American taxpayer, and also the Iraqi people. They were getting shortchanged. Everybody was getting shortchanged. So, I mean, that's a public service, isn't it?
Absolutely. Though I hesitate to call it a public service and prefer to refer to it more as an obligation. When I worked for the State Department, I worked for the American people. My oath of allegiance was to the Constitution, not to any political party. And I think it's important to stress that the issues that I blew the whistle on crossed over two administrations. Though I wasn't physically present during the George Bush administration in Iraq, the policies that I was enacting under the Obama administration were policies that began under Bush, running through two secretaries of state. And I want to draw that distinction because it's one thing to sort of gossip about, well, we don't like this guy, or this guy isn't, as sharp as he might be. And it's another thing to focus on an actual issue that is of importance to the United States. And perhaps let me draw an example with Trump. I mean, it's one thing to say that, I don't know, person X in his cabinet has poor hygiene and rarely takes notes. It's another thing to say that that same person does not appear to be well briefed and appears to be making decisions on very limited information. The first is more than likely gossip fodder. The second is an obligation to bring to the attention of the American people.
And again, I'm speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And following his book, the State Department began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. And through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. He has an article at the New York Times, When It's Time to Blow the Whistle. So is there any comparisons now? It seems that between what you did, where you were appalled at the waste and fraud and abuse at the expense of the American taxpayer and the Iraqi people, in the case of the leaks coming out of the White House, my sense is that these are people on the inside, some of them on Trump's team, who were just simply appalled by this complete out of control amateur who doesn't know what he's doing. And I think it's they're acting out of conscience and out of alarm. That's my impression. What's your impression?
I think there's a large component of it, and I'm on your side nearly 100%. I would just caution again against the difference between sort of gossip and information that's of value to the American people. And one bit of obligation in terms of sorting that out rests on the media. In my case, I chose to blow the whistle myself publicly through a book. And what we're seeing out of Washington, the majority of this information is coming out as leaks to journalists. And so in that case, the obligation to sort through the information and to put it in context really rests with the journalist. And so if someone passes on information, the job to say, hey, that's really just vindictive gossip, isn't it? Or, wow, that really exposes the flaws in the decision making, that shifts to the journalist. And I think that's one of the differences between it's a fuzzy line, but it can be one of the differences between an anonymous leaker and a whistleblower who's willing to go public and lay his or her cards on the table. For example, Edward Snowden did in fact work through journalists, but he did that by providing documents that ultimately the journalists put in front of all of us, the world's people, so we could judge it ourselves. And then as a critical reader, as a critical consumer of media, those are some things you would want to keep in mind as you read stories about the chaos and dissension and disorganization inside the Trump administration.
But in your case, you weren't leaking sort of on a day-to-day basis to the press. You wrote a book, and I take it when somehow the State Department got hold of a manuscript, and then suddenly your security clearance was suspended, and so was your diplomatic credentials. Had you signed anything? I mean, was there a legal basis to the punishment you got?
No, not really. The State Department approved my book through the vetting process that was then in place. And I think the State Department and I would agree that that vetting process was very limited. It was really designed for another era when retiring diplomats wrote their memoirs of a life in Tangiers or something like that. It was never really designed to deal with political speech. That said, political speech is one of those things that is strongly protected by the First Amendment, and the State Department attempted to use bureaucratic tools to do an end run around that First Amendment. They tended to try to dig around in their regulations and find something about, well, you can't make speeches without your boss's approval, things like that, without really acknowledging that I wasn't going out and making a speech about what current American policy in Israel is. I was reporting on events that occurred and were completed, and that was political speech, was protected by the First Amendment, and it took an ugly year and some very good lawyers at the ACLU and a woman named Jessalyn Raddick, who now is part of Edward Snowden's defense team. It took those efforts to bring the State Department around to understand that the First Amendment applies and does not end at, in this case, the State Department's front door.
So back to the White House and this anger. I mean, Donald Trump had his rally on Saturday down in Florida, and I must say his presidency is beginning to look sort of like Groundhog Day, where he keeps going back to what he's familiar with, which is the campaign, and he doesn't seem to be able to even get started on being president. And it was just a repetition of all of the campaign themes, except he really was going after the press more than ever, and that's really saying something. And, of course, it's all prompted by this sense of grievance that he has, that somehow he's being misrepresented. But then when he says stuff that's so crazy, like he was talking about terrorist acts in Sweden, and like everybody in Sweden is waking up today and saying, what was he talking about? There haven't been any, and certainly not since there was an influx of refugees has there been a terrorist incident in Sweden. So the whole thing, I think, came from something he saw on Fox News. So, I don't know, whether is fact-checking whistleblowing? I mean, what's the job of the press here? And how do you think this battle's going to shape up? Because the lines are drawn. Wow. He's picked a fight with two people that can fight back, the intelligence community and the press.
We live in very odd times. And if I knew how to sort this all out concisely, I'd write that up and put that in the New York Times for next week's op-ed. I think that it's an odd way to look at life, and it's an odd way to talk about the President of the United States, but I'm with only a slight attempt at humor, I think he's starting to sound like the drunk uncle at Thanksgiving. Every year Uncle Fred shows up and he has a little too much to drink, and he starts to rant and rave at the table. And over the years, the family has kind of learned not to pay a lot of attention to Fred. It's just what he does. And I'm almost tempted to say that there's an element of that with, and may these words not cause lightning, President Trump. He just doesn't say things in the way that other presidents or really any other politician has ever done. And I think we simply have to, for the time being, as the press, accommodate that in the sense that if Trump goes out and makes statement X, we have to sort of say, I'm sorry, that statement is untrue. Here is why. And not inflate that into another sign of the coming apocalypse. We've seen that with China, where the phone call he took from the Taiwan president in early January was inflated by the press into a change in U.S. policy from the one China policy that's been in place since the 1970s. And now that he's made nice with President Xi on a phone call and confirmed no change in U.S. policy, the press has turned around and announced that Trump has flip-flopped. Well, neither of those things really appear to be true. Basically, at the end of the day, despite some sort of silliness and rhetoric and some diplomatic clumsiness, nothing has changed. And I think we need to retool ourselves in the media to understand that this is an odd new normal, and we need to stop overreacting to things and start focusing on less on the process in terms of reporting, less on the process and more on the outcomes as we and Trump continue to evolve. And I think there will be evolution on his part. Perhaps I'm optimistic, but I'm going to stick with optimism today.
Well, but his job is not your average job, and words have consequences, particularly when you're president of the United States. You know, a slip of the tongue and you can have a nuclear war, So he is held to a higher standard, and one of the things that people find troubling is not just that he made up this story about terrorist attacks in Sweden that didn't happen. And you can excuse him saying, some ridiculously paranoid documentary that Fox made, some Muslim bashing thing that they did, somehow he retained that in his head and conflated it. But the other day at the press conference, where he again repeated this amazing victory that he claims to have had in the election, and a reporter finally pulled him over and said, no, you didn't have the greatest Electoral College victory since Ronald Reagan. Every president from Trump through to Ronald Reagan had considerably more Electoral College votes, all of them, some of them by huge margins. And finally, the reporter was able to point this out to him, and the best that Donald Trump could say was, well, that's what I was told. That was the information I was given. I mean, it's not very reassuring. You expect a higher standard of veracity from the president. I mean, Obama, by contrast, was so laborious in when he spoke. He was so careful. It was almost, you know, painful to listen because it took so long. But there's a certain comfort in knowing that the person that's in charge of the nuclear button is extremely careful and cautious, as opposed to reckless and completely has a very loose relationship with the truth.
And no arguments on my part. And I want to stress to your listeners that I am not in any sense defending Trump's actions or words or techniques. I'm trying to describe them as best I can and suggest that for the time being, he is the president, and that's a reality we cannot escape, and that he is going to be doing this differently, and we have to keep understanding what's happening and shifting along the way. I had a conversation with a friend of mine, a Canadian diplomat that I had served with in the same country overseas, and he was kind of laughing about how Canada has a secret class for its diplomats on how to deal with crazy Americans, and that, from time to time, America loses its mind briefly, but we got to kind of muddle forward with our relationship. And at the risk, again, of sounding like I'm either defending Trump or making a bad joke, I mean, that may be the way that we have to sort through what he's saying and doing. And I would suspect that some of our allies are probably coming to those same conclusions, that, you know, he's simply going to be this way. Hopefully he'll evolve. He may or may not, but there is a ground reality out there. He's the president of the United States, and he's going to act this way. And despite how much we may not want him to be president or hope that he'll change, that just simply may not be what happens here. It won't be pretty, but we will try to muddle through.
Well, Peter Van Buren, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, it's my pleasure. I suspect over the next 4 years, we will be still working on these issues and trying to parse them out.
Right.
And my hope would be that any whistleblowers or people who are considering blowing the whistle that may be listening are going to be picking up a phone one of these days and talking to a lawyer and considering acting on that conscience.
Well, we certainly, in my business, that's what we depend on. And I thank you very much for joining us here today, Peter Van Buren.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Van Buren, who's a 24-year veteran Foreign Service officer at the State Department, who spent a year in Iraq leading two State Department provincial reconstruction teams. He wrote about it in We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And following his book, the Department of State began termination proceedings against him, stripping him of his security clearance and diplomatic credentials. And through the efforts of the Government Accountability Project and the ACLU, he instead retired from the State Department with his full benefits. And he has an article at the New York Times, When It's Time to Blow the Whistle. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes Podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.